dbkmediaservices.com. You are listening to the Triple Crown Family Fun Center SVC Sports Talk Podcast. SVC Sports Talk is brought to you by SVCSportsZone.com and Triple Crown Sports. Now, here are your hosts for the Triple Crown Family Fun Center SVC Sports Talk, Shane Combs and Jeremy Ward.
Hello, SVC fans, and welcome to the Triple Crown Family Fun Center SVC Sports Talk podcast show. I'm Shane Combs of SVCSportsZone.com, and we come to you here. I want to let you know about our schedule coming up here. We said at the beginning of basketball, with some of the weird scheduling this year with the OHSAA time and with where Thanksgiving ended up falling and what happened to basketball season, we were going to adjust our schedule a little bit in order to utilize our 10 weeks to best maximize the coverage. So we're going to be with you here this week, and then we're going to take 2 weeks off for the holidays. And then once we come on back in early January, there we'll be with you pretty much weekly the rest of the way out. So just want to let you know as we gear up here for an exciting week of basketball, and then spend some time with the family here at home, and I'm sure we'll be in the gym several times, getting a chance to see some holiday action, and then we'll be back to SVC play there in January. I'm joined, as I always am, by Jeremy Ward, and Jeremy, as I welcome you to the show, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this past week in the SVC as we actually started to see some boys and girls action take place.
Yeah, you know, I think we've, on the girls' side, standings have started to take shape. And, you know, you see Westfall, Piketon, St. Trace, Unioto kind of separate themselves to the top of those standings. And on the boys' side, you know, I think a continuation of some of the things we talked about last year and the progression of Adina, you know, just fighting to break through. Lost the tough one on Friday night, came back and won a tight one on Saturday. And at the top of the boys' standings, you know, Zane Trace really flexed their muscles this weekend, and Southeastern really made a statement, I think, in the early going. So, yeah, the boys are just kind of revving up, and the girls are settling in.
Well, Jeremy, on Saturday, speaking of boys and girls, we had the all-day event, and we had one eval that I really enjoyed. I kind of got a chuckle out of it. The person says, I'm new to the show. Could tell from Jeremy's comments that Shane is not a big fan of the all-day event. This person here says, I really liked it. Had a chance to watch all the teams play in one day. Why does he not like it? And, you know, in all seriousness, I've said this a couple times before on the show. On paper, I think it is somewhat genius. I think all teams get an opportunity to play. A fan can come out one price all day, watch everybody. If you're an administrator, a booster, a worker, you get one less day that you have to be there throughout the year. Everyone is happier. So I can see why it's something that a lot of people enjoy. I just think the execution of the entire day can sometimes be a little confusing. You know, what time's the game going to start? What's the order of the game? Does this site have freshman boys? Is it going to have a JV girls two-quarter, four-quarter? I heard examples throughout the league where the locker room situation was a mess. You know, in all seriousness, I think it's fine. It's just for me, it's not something I'm a big fan of. Jeremy, as far as you as a fan and official, if you were a coach, you know, wear two, three different hats here. Just some of your thoughts on the all-day event from this past Saturday.
Well, you know, we've had some discussion on this in the past, but, you know, my feeling still, you know, I guess as an official, I'll start there because we kind of had an interesting day on Saturday, and I know you had some questions about these sorts of occurrences as well. You know, there was a boys event all day at Rio Grande. There was a girls event at Wellston where you had a lot of teams playing, and then the SVC had their all day event. Well, when anytime you have that much basketball being played, you know, on a particular site, time comes into question. You know, whether it's a overtime game or, you know, whatever circumstances surround it. You know, if you're under contract to be at a particular place, you know, you're expected to be there, and it can cause some problems with the officials. You know, I know a couple years ago, I ended up working a game at Paint Valley just because I was close enough to get there, and they were going to start so early that the, you know, one of the varsity officials was not going to be able to make it.
Right.
So, you know, those are real circumstances. In the locker room, not every school's equipped to handle that. So I think that is a big deal and something that, you know, you don't think about on the surface when you're putting that together, or, you know, even as a fan, you're not thinking about that. But definitely as a coach, you know, I think I heard of a couple teams that didn't even have their own locker rooms for their varsity game. And that's, you know, that makes it difficult. So there are negatives, but at the end of the day, you know, I think the concept is admirable, and I do think it gives an opportunity, especially at this point in the season, maybe to gain some fans for the girls, you know, and give everybody a chance to see both teams, both varsity programs in action.
Well, Jeremy, we have a lot of basketball to talk about this week before heading into the holiday break. But first, on the other side of the break, we react to some feedback on last week's SVC Sports in terms of how we compare to the surrounding areas. Jeremy, as I look into the inbox and I look at my notebook from face-to-face conversations I've had, and I tell you, there's just incredible feedback. Even have a phone call we'll get to here a little bit later. But the feedback on this volleyball discussion is really good. And if you weren't with us last week, we were talking about an email where someone was asking how volleyball is so incredible in terms of the level we play here in the Cider Valley Conference compared to the surrounding area. And we just don't see that in basketball and football and so forth. And, you know, Jeremy, we don't really have time to just break down every single email. So I thought what I would do here is just kind of summarize the feedback I was getting. And then I just wanted to throw it to you on some of these that maybe jump out at you. It says here, volleyball does have to compete against football, or does not have to compete against football the way, you know, girls basketball and boys basketball would have to do. They're talking there in that email about media coverage, scheduling, saying football is always going to be played on Friday night. I thought that was a pretty good point. I see another one here, club volleyball much bigger than AAU in terms of the basketball. Fall sport much easier to build than a winter sport, talking about the summer and preseason running together. Talking about how basketball battling through holiday scheduling and holidays in general make the season too long. I thought that was interesting. Right. And then one here disagrees with me from last week, saying that volleyball is a much harder skills game than basketball. So before I react to some of those, Jeremy, I just, as you look down through the list of all the feedback we've been given, and maybe even some face-to-face that you've had with other people, what are some things that jump out at you that you think makes for a worthy discussion?
I think those are interesting points, and a lot of those are things that, you know, came to mind when we talked about that last week, and, you know, as I got a little bit of feedback this week. A couple other things maybe to add in here, you know, in reference to the club AAU situation. You know, I've been directly involved with, you know, I think around 10 organizations, either as a coach or a parent. And, you know, one of the things that every volleyball organization that we've had, you know, a connection to, the focus and the mission was really on the player skill development, you know, related to the athlete and the game. Whereas with basketball and softball, the organizations that I've been involved with, the big picture has been the focus on next level exposure and next level contacts, you know, to progress their career, which I found that interesting. And it's not something I really thought about until I kind of went back and looked at some paperwork, looked at even some websites. And it's interesting just the way they approach, you know, their organizations, in the way they approach player development. Versus team of, you know, development and, you know, exposure to college coaches. The other thing that comes to mind that, you know, just kind of came to me in a conversation that I was having was that volleyball has fewer coaches. And what I mean by that, you know, at the lower level, there's less interference, you know, there's less stress. I don't know if it's only because it's a fall sport or if it's just because not as many people know about it. But, you know, even at the high school level, parents, grandparents, a casual fan, they're not as quick to question or second guess, or at least to the same extent as it happens in basketball, where, you know, and I'm sure I'm as guilty as anyone else. Ignorance truly can be bliss. And I think that that might be something that, you know, you have to consider.
Right. Well, I think both of those points are really, really good, because I know what you're saying about some of the teams that travel out, baseball, softball, basketball. I think you make a great point there about the team concept and but the individual doing so more in an exposure event and playing in some bigger types of events. I'll tell you, the one that really jumped out at me is I was surprised on the disagreement of the volleyball skills being harder. And by no means am I saying that volleyball is an easy sport to play, because that's not what I meant last week at all. But all I'm saying is volleyball has an ability to put kids into their strength and put them in a position where they can use that strength and hide a weakness. I think the same thing's true in a baseball or a softball. And, you know, Jeremy, you jump in there in softball if you think I'm wrong. But, like, I know in baseball, I always tell my kids, hey, there's a reason not everybody can be the catcher or play shortstop. It's a lot easier to teach a kid to play left field than it is shortstop. And I just think that it kind of goes back to your club volleyball thing in terms of the skill development. It's a much easier concept to take a kid in terms of, if you think it's going to be a smaller kid by the time she gets to the seventh, eighth, ninth grade, and you have a pretty good indication of what height that girl's going to be, teaching her to strictly pass. And although you might still put her through hitting drills, it's one of those things where you understand, okay, this person right here is going to be a passer the rest of her volleyball career. Where on the basketball court, you just can't really do that and have a quality product in terms of your entire team. I'm not saying that every team doesn't have, you know, different role players where their job's to go in there and set screens, rebound, or whatever. But if that's all that kid can do, at some point that's going to limit that particular team from being really, really good. Go ahead.
And Shane, I'll jump in there. The one thing that, you know, I would counter a little bit, and I don't know that I completely disagree. I think when you're talking about overall and a finished product and the reasons why some of our basketball teams aren't as well developed, or, you know, as a team structure, you know, I agree with you 100%. From the individual standpoint and just whichever team you're watching in particular, I would say that it's much more difficult to take a year or two off and come back and play baseball or softball, or come back and play volleyball. Whereas you might be able to do that in basketball because you're athletic enough. You might be able to jump in, and yes, you may not be able to score and handle the ball, but you might be able to have a role as, you know, a 2 or 3 minute, like you said, into a particular role.
I guess
you,
if you're
need
talking,
those kids.
Yeah, I guess if you're talking a couple minute role, I guess this took me back to our email on our preview in terms of the ugly basketball. And that's got us thinking. Remember, we were discussing fundamentals and the, just kids knowing how to play.
Right.
I think the biggest thing I see nowadays is less teams, boys and girls, less teams have kids that can just simply dribble, pass, and catch the basketball.
Right.
So what happens is you get the ball being dominated more by one, maybe two players, and it really just hurts the flow of the entire game. And I guess that's what I'm saying about in basketball, the lack of development has almost forced the game into that standpoint, where in volleyball you might be able to hide those particular things. If a kid can pass, there's specific things they can do. So
I think the one thing, just to be clear for everybody, is depending on how you're looking at it, you know, when you're trying to gauge the finished product and why you need all this to happen to have successful basketball, you know, these are the discrepancies that we're missing. And it's easier for kids to fall in those roles in the other sports. So just so, because I, you know, when I get questions about that, I don't think they're looking at it from the same perspective that you are when they're questioning what you're saying as far as basketball skills being more difficult.
And that's probably fair. And before we get to our phone call, I would just add in here, off of this list of feedback that we've been given when we talk, you know, summer camps, when we talk development, little leagues, culture, all those words that we were using last week, I think that that's happening more in some of these surrounding areas. You know, your Southern Hills League, some of the schools in the SOC, those are some of the schools that come out, you know, come jumping forward to me when I think of this in terms of they are getting that at a young age, and they are getting that really up through their junior high programs and even into high school. And the love of the sport is probably promoting a little bit more numbers in terms of keeping kids involved. Now, I was excited to get a phone call this week because we had one fan, Jeremy, that really gave a nice perspective. Let's take a listen here to his reasoning.
I believe one of the reasons that volleyball is so much better in the SVC now than basketball has so much to do with club volleyball. The AAU basketball, each school in the SVC only has maybe one or two players participating in that. And if you look at the club volleyball, some of the schools like Adena, we have 10 girls or more involved with club volleyball, so they're getting to play a lot more. And I think that's made a huge difference in the last 10 years, not to just make one team in the SVC really good, but to bring up all the other teams and make them so much better. And the other thing I feel as far as basketball is, not knocking the basketball coaches at this time, but I feel that if you look at volleyball, you've got the old school coaches that put the time in, run a program through the summer, put a lot of time in. You look at basketball, we lost a lot of those coaches, the Gary Kellos, the Larry Jordans, the Ron Lovelies, where they ran camps all summer. They went to team camps and they did those things. You don't have that anymore, and it's not enough, but you just have coaches that they don't feel like they put the time in. And one other thing that I have regarding that is I also feel that, and it may be a financial situation, but if you look at a lot of these volleyball schools that are successful, look at their junior high coaches. They have great coaches. You look at basketball now, sometimes the junior high coaches are just people to fill a position. And that really, your best coaches should be coaching at 7th and 8th grade. Makes a huge difference. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I love the feedback. I love the phone call. Jeremy, I actually divided this call up into about three segments here, and I wanted to touch on all those and get your feedback. First, I thought it was really interesting, the number of club volleyball to AAU. Let me ask you this question, fair or unfair. Would you say that it's easier for all levels of talent to get involved in club volleyball than it is AAU? Seems like to me a lot of times the AAU, as you said, is more of an exposure-driven thing where if you're not already pretty elite for your age group, it becomes a little bit tougher to get involved. Fair?
Well, it's fair. And I think the point that I would make to that is I think in Ross County, we're a little bit spoiled because we have multiple organizations right here close that have multiple teams in each division. So there are a lot more opportunities. Now, why are there opportunities is because there's that much interest. So, you know, one fuels the other. Mm-hmm. So the opportunity starts it, but you know, just the sheer interest, you know, drives that. So, you know, that's one interesting point because that's definitely an advantage that our kids have over some of the other areas where they have to drive, you know, an hour to find a team to play on.
Well, and another point I thought was really interesting, I think of Coach Jordan, I think of Coach Kello, Coach Lovely. Those are people I have an incredible amount of respect for. I played against teams coached by Coach Jordan and Coach Kello. I played for Coach Lovely. I've been a head coach against all three of those people. So obviously an amazing amount of respect for what they've done for the game of basketball here in the Ross County area. But I'll say this maybe in defense of my profession today and the coaches that you know, are out there on the everyday grind, that the amount of time that goes in today is amazing. And these people work pretty hard at it. The summer rules have changed. You're traveling incredible distances. You're paying a lot of out-of-pocket costs just to have, you know, summer basketball and trying to keep up. I'll grant you there probably needs to be some more summer camps and some different things go on. But the money and the time is amazing. And the coaching turnover is a lot quicker nowadays. And I think that leads to a lack of consistency in your off-season camps, your off-season open gyms, and some of the different things. You know, one thing Dave Shoemaker, who would be another coach I'd throw into that mix, who's back at Paint Valley now, said one time to me, he's like, just because we used to do it different doesn't mean we did it wrong. And right. I think that's a great point because it's one of those things of it's, you know, when we look back to the little leagues and we look back to the way we used to structure it, I think you could make the argument, well, the numbers used to be a little bit better, the product used to be a little bit better, and I think that's where volleyball has taken off in this generation, and kind of they've started to do it better at all the levels leading up, therefore the product at the end's been a little bit better. Just wanted to get your take on the difference, Jeremy, in coaching maybe back when we played compared to maybe when we first started coaching and now that we've been in it about 10 to 15 years.
Well, I think right off the bat, you would get some people that would argue that, your point about longevity and your point about turnover in coaches, I think that has a big part of it. I think you're forced to do things differently when you take over a program because there's not the certainty that, you know, you're hired there as a teacher, you're going to coach, you're going to be a part of that community, you're all in. Well, that's a difficult situation to put somebody in now. I mean, first of all, there's not a lot of young guys coming up through the profession that, you know, there's so much asked of you as an educator that, and there are a lot of schools that even discourage you being a coach when you get started, at least a head coach, just simply because of all the things that, you know, you're responsible for in your profession. So what does that lead to? That leads to a lot of coaches being outside the school system, which that makes it harder to fill all those roles that all those people you talked about and the call mentioned in terms of, you know, really being ingrained in the community and having the opportunity to be ingrained in the community. And I think, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into that, but that is the one telling sign to me. I don't know that the amount of time put in is the way I would go. I really question that. I think the rules limitations play a factor there, but just the fact that job security is definitely not a given, and just the involvement of having teachers available and people around the kids, even if your head coach is not in the school system, you got to have people that are around those kids every day. You got to have that constant connection with the school and with the district and with the community and kind of be intertwined.
Well, you make an incredible point about how education's changed. Just 10 years ago when you'd start teaching, they would almost ask you in an interview, hey, would you be willing to coach 2-3 sports? We really think it's important that we have educators around our kids and our extracurricular activities, where nowadays, let's face it, with all the cuts and the different things going on, sometimes it benefits you if you're not locked in one place in terms of that. I want to mention one thing in the call, the final thing about the financial thing, the money, because I know it used to be far more commonplace that a lot of these coaches were paid. And some schools still do, but it's not nearly as common. Maybe for weightlifting, they're paid for open gyms. They're paid for camps. If you do a summer camp, they pay you for your time. They pay you for Little League. That used to be a very common thing in boys and girls basketball. They give you a stipend for your Little League within your pay. Where nowadays, those things have been taken out for probably a lot of different reasons at schools. I know some schools that I obviously won't mention, but there's been a lot of examples over the last 10 years where certain situations where head coaches have been attacked. That was one of the things that would be nitpicked at a little bit. So over time, in cuts, the some of those stipends have been taken out. Now, I know the first feedback I'm going to get, so I'll go ahead and head it off now. The first inbox I'm probably going to read here within the next week is, well, as a coach, you should want to do these things because it makes your program better. I don't disagree, and I can honestly say that if you line up 5-6 coaches, probably 4 or 5 of them would do it anyway because of what you're saying. But at the same time, I think we all understand that we like to be compensated for our time. You know, if you're in your job place here at the holiday season, I'm sure you don't go to your boss and say, hey, if you need me to stay 3 or 4 extra hours to work a little bit more, whatever's best for the company. You know what I mean? It's one of those things that, yes, we want to do it for kids. Yes, you want to do it for your program. But from a professional side of things, the kids aside, you're looking at it from the standpoint of what are we investing? What kind of support system do I have? And it may not just be money for the head coach. It may be, as the call said, what's the financial setup? Am I allowed to pay a varsity assistant? Most schools have lost those. Am I allowed to pay just 2 junior high coaches? where I know it used to be more commonplace, they might pay two junior high coaches, but they might try to have at least a little smaller stipend just to have an extra person available because they felt like it would give more one-on-one instruction time. Jeremy, now that you're into the athletic administration side and you coach all sorts of sports, what are some of the changes you've seen on the financial aspect of it, and then how much of the help that you need from outside of your program if you're going to make some of these little league programs work?
Well, I think that's where I would go with it in terms of your help. In terms of the availability of the people that you have around you, you know, some places you're lucky enough to have people that want to be involved, that can give you resources, whether it's, you know, helping you out with donations or whether it's just their time. And their positive relationships that they can help you with and develop with your kids, to help you reach all your goals in terms of, you know, to starting a program and developing at the younger levels. I mean, you just can't do that all on your own, and you certainly can't do that with just one or two helpers. It takes an enormous amount of support. An enormous amount of buy-in from all facets, from, you know, people that are directly involved with kids at the high school, and then people that are going to be involved because they have kids involved at the lower levels. You just have to have so much support, and that's really the difference that I've seen. You know, you go back to those names on that list; they had assistants that, you know, were synonymous with those programs, and
absolutely,
those are people that you would see around. That's very difficult nowadays. It's very difficult. You just hope that you're lucky enough to be someplace where you can bring people with you that you trust and that can be a positive influence on your athletes.
Well, Jeremy, this is obviously an incredible conversation. This is something that we could probably do an entire show on. So thankful for the phone call and probably, like I said, 6-7 different emails that we tried to at least touch on. Definitely want to let fans know they can get involved. You can call 740-569-3254. It's just a message system. Leave a message on there. We'll keep your name out of it. Let us know your comment, question, and then we'll pick some of them out and use them on the show here. So, well, fans, I'll tell you what, stay with us. On the other side of the break, we take a look at how things are starting to take shape in the way that is making many people's preseason thoughts seem correct. Well, I'll tell you what, Bruce gets us in the holiday spirit mm-hmm. there a little bit. And
that it is, Edward, that it is.
as we said there at the beginning of the show, we'll take 2 weeks off here for the holiday. And Jeremy, staying with Bruce's theme, I guess, as we start to look at some of the headlines on the boys and girls side, maybe we should take a look at what some of the coaches would like to see in their stocking. I mean, it's probably a situation where on the boys' side, I've heard a lot of the coaches talking depth or lack thereof on the scoreboard show the other night. I know on the girls' side, a lot of people maybe wanting some more offense. Let me ask you, on the boys' side, if you were to look at a headline or just something that maybe jumped out at you from the Friday, Saturday night back to back, maybe something, give us something from the boys' side that you thought was interesting.
I went back through all of the games thus far, and my headline would be fight through the 50s. with very few exceptions, once you got into the 50s, you're winning games. And, you know, you look, teams at the top, they can put up 60, 70 points every night. St. Trace, Southeastern especially, has proven they can score. And I think what comes with being able to score points at that rate into today's game is you've got to be able to score in all three boxes. You got to score two-point field goals. You have to be able to hit threes, and you have to make free throws. You know, right now, Union and Piketon, they haven't really proven that they can do that consistently and night in and night out and really be good in all three columns. And, you know, part of that's attributed to the schedules they played, especially non-league. Their schedules have been brutal. But, you know, I think that says a lot towards, you know, which teams that can separate themselves and really, you know, avoid the upsets, I think comes into it. Because so many of our teams, I just don't know if they can consistently get to 50 or 55 points.
You make a great point about just making shots. You know, when I thought of my headline, I was like back to the days of the back-to-back. You know, you remember you and I had talked here recently mm-hmm. about – And that's all I ever really knew. That's what I grew up with. I love the Friday Saturday, and I think Friday Saturday is a lot about seniors. It's a lot about leadership because it limits the teaching of the coach, and it's one of those in-game adjustments. And I think we'd all would agree, the more experienced your basketball team is, the more you can adjust in-game. And you talked about making shots. I know Friday night I saw Uniota jump out on Huntington. I think it was even 19-3, if I remember correctly. And slowly but surely, Huntington just kind of creeped their way back into it. And I saw Coach Kello make a lot of adjustments. And the one thing Huntington has, even though they don't have great depth, is they do have an experienced group. And they're mm-hmm. very familiar with him. Even as a first-year coach, they're very familiar with him. And he was able to do some different things, got back in it. But then as Coach Hoops and his team, as their depth started to take over, basically the difference in that game was Corcoran, his ability just to make shots. And you talked about, you know, points and fighting through the 50s. It was one of those things. I don't have that score in front of me. I want to say it was 56-48. I think that's right. And that was a game that I just thought Corcoran was really, really good down the stretch. I want to say he had 10 of his 14 in the fourth quarter. He hit two or three really, really difficult shots. And I just thought that was a player that really, really stuck out. Speaking of players, Jeremy, maybe give us a player or maybe a particular game or even an upcoming game that jumps out at you there on the boys' side.
Well, as far as upcoming games, you know, Southeastern, I think they've got a big week. They have Piketon and Uniota both this week. Uniota with a makeup on Saturday, but both those games are at home, so I'm looking forward to those matchups and really give the Panthers a test. Player-wise, I was really impressed with the consistent efforts so far of Jonathan Thomas and Wyatt Brewster, especially knowing that their teams are going to rely on them to score and that the other teams are going to focus on limiting their opportunities. They've both been very, very solid so far.
Yeah, I tell you, I agree with what you're saying there. And that was 56-48. I went ahead and pulled up the scoreboard here. And I also wanted to say that I thought Eric Hosley's play over the weekend was really solid. You know, Huntington, I know, had a tough weekend. Jeremy, they played Uniota and Zane Trace. And then Paint Valley played Southeastern and Zane Trace. So obviously your schedule can impact early on. You mentioned in our opening, Adina was an interesting team to watch this past weekend, as was Piketon. So some of the different matchups on the back-to-back can definitely give you multiple looks at a particular team. The one kid that jumped out at me, I saw him in the opening weekend, and he seemed a little timid to me as a freshman point guard, but this past weekend, really a little bit more aggressive. Wyman up at Westfall, Corey Wyman, he's a freshman point guard. If you haven't had a chance to see this kid play, I think it's one you're going to enjoy, Jeremy. I watched him play three or four times in the eighth grade, and he's just got a real nice skill set. He has good feet, has a pretty good ability to create his own shot. I think he had 13 on Friday night, came back Saturday in the near win over Adina where they lost 58-56, hit 5 3-pointers, had 20 points. So he's a kid that's jumping out at me as an underclassman as well. Well, I'll tell you what, if we shift over to girls, maybe let's just go the same way here, Jamie. A headline or something that jumped out at you here on the girls' side this past week.
Still good to be read. Westfall, Piketon, Zane Trace, just not willing to give up their spots in the top half of the league. And, it really interesting to see if that's the way it would play out this year, or if a Paint Valley or a Huntington or a Southeastern could kind of jump up. And so far, that hasn't happened. And the bottom four have not been able to win a game over the top four, like I mentioned earlier. I don't think that that's, you know, going to hold true throughout the season. I think there's still going to be a little more parity like we expected. But, you know, that would be my headline.
I think on the girls' side, I would go offense anyone. You know, it's just one of those things we've touched on this a little bit. It's It's just it's the number one difference I'm seeing. I guess it's almost the same point you're making, just in a different way, Jeremy. Those top teams that you're talking about, it just seems like they have the ability to score the basketball just a little bit more, and it really puts the stress on your defense when you're trying to win a 33-32 game. Your ability to stretch that up into 40, 45, 50 almost eliminates some of these teams. So you just see it. We know how talented Uniota is. Obviously, Westfall, we talked about their incredible depth. But even as you get into the middle with Zane Trace, I thought Pontius was the complete difference in Saturday's game against Huntington. Cox and Robinson of Westfall and Uniota, they kind of gotten off to a slow start, and then they kind of explode a little bit. I know for Huntington, Sams has been in double figures all six games. They're still trying to develop multiple scores. Alexis Putnam's a kid for Adina that ended up giving Coach Skaggs a nice game earlier in the week, and a couple kids like Shea and Foster there. That's just, as I look down through the scoreboard, some of the names jumping out at me. Maybe give us a couple individuals that caught your attention, Jeremy, or maybe even look ahead here at an upcoming game that you think is going to be pretty crucial in the standings.
Well, I'm interested to see Huntington's matchup with Southeastern. You have contrasting styles. I think Kaylee Heiss has played extremely well to this point, and she's going to be an imposing figure for Huntington, and they're definitely going to want to limit second chance points and try to keep Southeastern off the boards and try to make the game happen in between the three-point lines instead of in the scrimmage area, I think. So, that's kind of the game that I'm looking at. And, player-wise, the one thing that kind of caught me is that, Torrey Cox at Uniota and Robinson at Westfall both finally were in the scoring leaders. And I was a little surprised that hadn't happened as of yet. And I think we all know they impact the game regardless if they score. But, just kind of breaking out and getting up in the 20s or near 20 for two of the better players in the conference.
I think that's a great point, Jeremy. I think what you see there is two things, in my opinion, and maybe give me your feedback here. I think with Robinson maybe being asked to handle the basketball a little bit more with Swaggerty gone, as we touched on in our preview show, teams maybe with Uniota's incredible size maybe trying to really key on Torrey. Mm-hmm. And I think it also has a lot to do with their depth. They don't have to force it. Right. The old cliche of let the game come to you. Let's face it. There's some kids that around the league, they don't have time to let the game come to them. They've got to go get it. It's one of those things where their team needs them to shoot the basketball and score. I think those two teams have such nice depth of talent that those two particular kids can maybe take on the double team a little bit more, or recognize the defense being played and be a little bit more patient. Would you agree with that?
Right. Just take what the defense gives you. There are some teams that they don't have that luxury. Their scores have to score, and they only have, so many weapons at their disposal. You don't necessarily, you can't play the game that way and just let the game come to you, or if they take something away, do something else. So I think that's a great point.
Real quick before we move on, too, I wanted to mention thoughts and prayers, SBCSportsZone.com, out to Peyton Reuter. I hated to hear with her knee injury. I was actually there the night that happened at Southeastern, and at first you could tell she was hurt, but it didn't appear to be as serious as it ended up being on the MRI the next day. And haven't had a chance to talk to Coach Carino at the all-day event there on Saturday, because this happened earlier in the week, but it was my understanding through some Facebook contact on SVC Sports Zone. You can follow us there on Facebook. It's my understanding that everything went pretty well there. And then now you're off to the normal recovery time where, you try to push it 4 or 5 months if you're pushing it. But we've obviously seen different athletes adjust in different times. So just hate that for a kid that obviously loves sports. You only get to do this 4 years of your life. And, when you kind of have an injury, jump in there and get you. So we want to see Peyton back, hopefully next fall on the volleyball court, really, really ready to go. So I guess I'll ask you real quick, Jeremy, in terms of Piketon, how that impacts them. They lose their point guard. I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is it really forces Coach Carino into a huge lineup. That's the one thing that kind of you're going to talk about a pretty big lineup if you're moving Lawhorn to the one. Legg's a pretty big two or three. You could even move Pelfrey's versatility there. I know Ward and Pack in the middle. Just what's your take on maybe where that impacts Pike in the most moving forward?
Well, if anybody's equipped to deal with that, I mean, it's Coach Carino. He's been a little unlucky in those regards in the past, and he's, you know, continues to go at it. And I think what you will see is how they've been able to develop some experience the last few years. You've got a lot more kids at your disposal that, you know, have been there and know what it takes to play. So, you know, I think they'll step up and they'll continue to be, you know, one of the top teams, and they'll make their adjustments and do what they have to do.
Real quick here, looking at the inbox too, Jeremy, I hate not to get this back when we're getting great feedback, because I know we're not going to be on the air for 2 weeks. Holiday break coming up. There was a question being asked about, would you rather play a lot of games, no games? What's the impact on your team? I guess for me, it goes back to our scheduling discussion. I guess all situations are different. Were you a boys team that had a football team make a long playoff run? Are you an experienced team? Can you use the extra week or two of practice where you don't have a game? It's almost like a camp in today's time. You know what I mean? In mm-hmm. a lot of ways, if you have that free week of practice where you don't have a game, it's almost like you're getting a free off-season camp in season where everyone's there. You do lose conditioning. You probably do lose some execution. Just your thoughts before we move into our fast break on how you best like to handle the holiday break.
I want my schedule to be consistent, so I don't mind having, you know, maybe a week between games, but I don't want to go with only, you know, two games in 3 weeks, that type of scenario. So, you know, maybe you don't have two games a week, but I want some sort of consistency with my schedule so that, you know, you can take off some days around the holidays, but you're not really out of the rhythm that you've worked hard to create in the early going.
Well, and again, that's a great email, and I just thought it was something we really needed to talk about before the break, because you'll see a little bit of everything if you really study the schedules mm-hmm. of the boys and girls. That's 16 different things that some play 3-4 times, some don't play at all. Some have used it for makeup dates to throw in there where we've had some early bad weather. So definitely interesting, something we'll keep an eye on. And when we come back on our next show, we'll talk about maybe how we think it's impacted some teams as they take the floor again. So, well, fans, I'll tell you what, at this point, let's head to our fast break section. If you're not familiar, fans, this is the point of the show where we like to speed things up a little. Bruce will throw some questions at Jeremy and I, and we'll both give our thoughts for boys and girls. Jeremy will respond first. I'll follow. So let's get out and transition. Fast break.
One email from earlier in the week was asking fair, unfair in terms of free throw shooting, not impacting things as much as Shane predicted in the preview show.
Free throws were definitely huge in the Zane Trace Union at a boys game last weekend. Whether you talk about made, missed, or just lack of attempts for the physicality of that game. And, you know, multiple times this year already, I've seen poor free throw shooting keep a lot of games closer than they should have been. But in reference to an increase of attempts related to rule changes, officiating changes, that really hasn't happened. So I would say that that's fair.
Well, as a coach, Jeremy, obviously I think free throw shooting is important. You get fouled, you got to knock them down, especially late in the game and some of those time score situations. But for what this question is asking, I definitely think it's fair. I've been wrong, and Jeremy was definitely right in terms of the amount of whistles and the different things they're looking. Now, I have seen some focus on some ball screens and some officials maybe anticipating that and trying to clean that up a little bit. But the overall game, still pretty loose. Maybe I would say that the boys game has been a little looser. I have seen some girls games called a little tighter at times. But the one thing I throw in there real quick is I know I used to like to scout officials from the standpoint of keep a little notebook and even just trying to teach your kids how to adjust. And I think coaches have to do the same. If you have certain crews over and over and over, I think you start to get a sense of how the game's going to be called. And I think it's important to just adjust. And that's been part of the game of basketball forever.
When analyzing the Good Health chiropractic scoreboards and or the Valero standings, what is something that jumps out at you?
Well, I feel pretty good about who the top half teams are in the boys and girls. I'm a little surprised there hasn't been, you know, anyone jump up and get one of those top teams, like I said earlier. But, you know, I think the parity will come. I do think you're going to have a good bit of shakeup, and I still think that one of those bottom teams is going to end up in the top four. And I'd even go out on a limb and say in both the boys and the girls.
Well, Jeremy, when I look at the Valero standings, I see on the boys' side the SVC's 3-7 in the non-league, and on the girls' side, the SVC's 9-14 in the non-league. So obviously, that's been a tough start out of conference. But when I look down through the scoreboard, and again, thank you to Chris Good for his sponsorship there. But when I look down through the scoreboard, I see on the boys' side, Bloom Carroll, Valley twice, Circleville. On the girls' side, Benton County, Peebles, Lynchburg, Jackson, McLean twice. So there's been some pretty good basketball teams being played in the non-conference. So, but that goes back to our scheduling debate. I would really tell SVC teams that don't panic or don't overreact. Just, you know, you make schedules and you play them out for a particular reason. Just use it to get better and move forward.
With all the youth getting attention around the league, who is a senior who is impacting the league to this point in a big way?
Lacey Stanforth, you know, she's got to produce at Paint Valley for them to be able to compete, and, you know, and she's proven that she can do that. Mentioned earlier, Haley Heiss at Southeastern, you know, very consistent points and rebounds and giving the Panthers a chance. On the boys' side, I think Jordan Allen has been outstanding so far, and Connor Smith at Zane Trace has definitely been an impact player on a team with, you know, plenty of weapons. And one thing that also that I'd mentioned there, you know, we talked about Piketon is, you know, the absence of seniors at Piketon like Farmer and Jenkins and how that may impact the standings as a whole.
I like what you're saying there at Piketon, because I think of Pelfrey obviously being a really good player, but her versatility and just some of the ways she's going to help that team adjust through the Reuter injury we mentioned earlier. But I would go to Zane Trace. I know the headlines a lot of times going to read Strahl's ball, but I really think the Pontius girl is a really nice player. She's really, like I mentioned earlier, I thought she was the difference in the game the other day. Huntington got within five in the second half of that game, and she hit two just break-your-back three-pointers. It's going to do some things off the dribble, and that's only going to make Kylan that much more difficult to guard moving forward. So I think Jillian Pontius on the girls' side would definitely be mentioned there. And then I like your selections on the boys' side. I would throw the Anderson kid in at Westfall. I think he's helped them compete. But I also like Sarvard Huntington. I think his versatility, he can play three, four different positions on the court, and I think he brings some versatility to a team that's still trying to develop some depth.
Another email is asking if you guys believe depth is the single biggest factor in this year's SVC races for boys and girls.
Maybe not as much in terms of how many players a coach uses on a given night, but definitely in the terms of the amount of weapons at your disposal. Southeastern, Zane Trace, Uniota boys all, I would say, have five or more capable of going for double figures. You know, we've talked about, as the show's going on, the main objective is to put the ball in the hole. And if you can do that, you've got a big advantage. And with girls, I think you quickly see that there are some teams that rely on one or two players to do the majority of their scoring and have a lot of difficulties scoring enough points to have a chance at the end of the game, especially if one of those kids are taken out, you know, by defenses.
Jeremy, I think the answer is yes here all the way, but for different reasons. I think on the boys' side, I do have to say a little bit when the back-to-back comes into play and in practice situations trying to push one another to get better. I think Zane Trace Union of Southeastern has a huge advantage in that sense. So when I think of the boys' game, I do think of depth as meaning being able to go to the bench, get a sixth, seventh, eighth man in there to play a role, and as you say, even score the basketball in spots. Now on the girls' side, I look at depth meaning a little bit more of the ability to score the basketball. I touched on it earlier. When you go to the top with a Uniota, then with a Westfall, and then you look in that next tier of, say, a Zane Trace and a Piketon and even a Southeastern trying to stick their nose in, the biggest difference is simply having that second and third person that can score, create their own shot. And I think that's something to definitely keep your eye on moving forward. Well, fans, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, or in the inbox, admin1@svcsportzone.com. And love to hear from you at 740-569-3254. As you heard earlier on that phone number, a call comes in, really generates some great discussion. So I think it really adds to the show. Appreciate that call and hope to get some more from our SVC listeners. Well, Jeremy, now it's time for, you know, my favorite part of the show, and I'm sure yours as well, the Liar Liar Stripes on Fire. And this particular week had a really interesting topic come up, one that I even noticed in a game here recently that I thought was kind of interesting, and then you and I even got discussing it. And the more we talked about it, I just thought it would be real good discussion here on the show, talking about the flop. And the flop, yeah, whatever people's opinion might be of the flop, and for some of our listeners that don't understand the basketball terminology there, flop, we're just simply referring to maybe a lot of times where a defender or an offensive player just kind of maybe sells it a little bit to show some contact or to try to draw a foul. Oftentimes you'll use it against another team's best player, just trying to maybe get them in foul trouble a little bit. Good strategy. What you look for as an official, maybe some good acting versus bad acting. Just talk us from an official's perspective on how the flop is involved in the game of basketball.
Well, I'm sure as everybody knows, because you know they see it time and time again, is the flop, if it is indeed a flop, is a technical foul. And you know, we've seen that called many times. Well, no, we haven't, but anyway, but it is, you know, by rule in the rule book, a flop is a technical foul. And, you know, if you talk about good acting versus bad acting, and is it part of the game? It certainly is. Does anybody want to call a technical foul? No, they don't want to call a technical foul. They don't want to have that kind of impact on the game. But it has in the past few years become much more noticeable. I think that starts with the NBA, and then there's a lot of focus, and it becomes an ESPN topic, which brings it to everybody, I think. As far as the strategy, I think usually you're targeting, you know, the other teams, one of the other, you know, one of your opponent's better players. So, you know, you're just looking at it probably two scenarios. The majority of the time, it's either, you know, you're gonna do a great acting job and maybe get that one extra foul that takes that player out of the game, whether it be in the first half or maybe has them foul out later on, and that definitely impacts the game, especially at the high school level. But generally, if you don't get the call, it becomes a no call. So, you know, pretty decent risk. Now, I'd say the downside of it as a strategy, I think if you get the official's attention with poor acting, then it's going to be very difficult for you to get any calls on contact. And chances are, if it's a 50-50 type play, and you know, coaches talk about that with loose balls, and everybody talks about it with the block charge, I'd say at the end of the day, you know, you probably have a harder time getting that to go your way. And you know, I think you just kind of maybe put it in everybody's head that you're flopping anyway, so it's probably a block if it's a foul.
I guess my question for you, Jeremy, as a fan, as a coach, as a former player, just to you as an official, would be, I assume it's a lot easier to tell if you're staring right at it and you see the old, you know, post player catches it, he or she starts to make a drop step move, and you see the contact, and then you can probably gauge a little bit better the good acting versus the bad acting. I think the more difficult call, and I saw one of these the other night, I don't feel comfortable on the air here giving the teams, but I'll just kind of paint the picture and give a scenario. It was one of the league's better players, and she was running the floor, and the defender kind of met her halfway into the secondary break, right around the elbow area. She started to flash to the post, and she kind of gave the sell job a little bit and got the call, and it really ended up kind of impacting the game because of foul trouble. Is that the more difficult one, where maybe you're running in transition, or maybe your eyes weren't on it, and then all of a sudden you realized you kind of see the reaction of the player falling, and then obviously one side of the gym is going to go crazy? Is that the more difficult call? Do you sometimes an official, you know, not call it, or maybe do call it based on the reaction of the player if you didn't see it in transition? Am I making myself clear there on what I'm saying?
Yeah,
asking?
You know what? I think that's a great point, because, you know, it brings into call that the elbow area can be a gray area for officials, because that's where all three primary areas meet. Mm-hmm. You know, for when you're talking about primary calling areas for your officials, so you know, your trail, your lead, your center, all of them kind of they kind of intersect right there at the elbow. So that's one of those calls where everybody's kind of got a shot at it. But if there's movement, you also may have a switch, an official switch. And so you're leaving one official's primary and entering another. And when it comes right there at that elbow, there might be that split second delay that might allow for a no call or a late call. Either way, the fans aren't going to be happy. And, you know, again, the official's job at the end of the day is to get it right, even if it's a second late. But I think that's a great question, because there are things that happen there. The other thing you see a lot at the elbow in that scenario, as far as offensive, defensive, is you get the drive and transition, or I'm sorry, you get the drive and penetration towards that elbow, maybe from left side to the right side elbow or vice versa, where you're changing right. sides of the floor. Now you get a quick move and a quick pass. The ball's moving and most people's eyes go with the ball. Well, then you have the passer go into the defensive player. Now, is a defensive player acting, selling his job, or is the offensive player out of control? So I think that's a similar scenario, that sometimes because of where it happens, you get a delayed call or maybe a no call because, well, the ball's going away from the basket. Is it just incidental contact? It doesn't affect the play. You know, there's a lot of things that play into that. But I think that's another great point. Sometimes things look bad and you think, how can there be that much contact and no foul? Well, sometimes if it doesn't affect the play, you know, you might not get the call. And other times, because you might have two officials where it's right there in their area, you might have a double whistle and they both get it, or you might have them both pass on it.
Well, real quick then, talk me through the ball screen in a little bit, because that's the one area I've seen the officials maybe really starting to clean it up and anticipate, and I've seen that a little bit more consistent across the board. And I think the flop comes into play here a little bit even. I know some people will almost teach the defender, as you come up on the contact, kind of clip the shoulder, maybe snap the head a little bit, or you'll just see a lot of different techniques being used, almost as the flop is being taught. What is it that you're looking for a lot of times as the two players come into contact that maybe you can tell, was it legitimate contact, or was one player maybe selling it a little bit more than the other?
Well, I think coaching does play a role there, and I think you have to remember with a screen that, you know, you're entitled to your space on the floor as a defensive player just as the offensive player, and when neither of them have the ball, it can be interesting, because, you know, you're not a player in motion with the ball and with the dribble and that sort of thing. So, you know, if you're going to screen, you've got to keep your feet inside your body. You can't spread outside your body, and you certainly can't have your elbows out away from your body. And when that contact comes, you know, the defensive player can't fight through that either. You know, when a coach says fight through the screen, he doesn't literally mean fight the guy and drag it into the ground, you know, and you see that sometimes. And I think you get the shoulders, you know, the shoulders going out, or like you say, you know, the acting where you
I think when the defender clips the shoulder is the hardest call for the official, because mm-hmm. the screener very well might have gotten there in time and been still, but the well-coached teams, as they fight through, as you call it, a lot of times they clip that shoulder and it can almost appear a moving screen. That's a very difficult call right. for an official.
Right, and I would swing that right back to you as a coach and ask you, do you think the hardest thing about teaching screens is for your players to use them effectively? Because that leads to problems, because you're giving up
too much
space.
There's no doubt about it, because you're talking about the angles of, one, are you going to go screen? We always call it screen the jersey. You got to go screen mm-hmm. someone. You got to go seek them out and screen them. But at the same time, the player either dribbling off the ball screen or coming off of and away from the ball screen. Obviously, you've got to be patient. You've got to set up shoulder to shoulder. So screening is going to obviously lead to contact. And I think anytime there's contact, there's going to be different levels of contact. And that's where I think the flop is just a great discussion piece to get a viewpoint of the official, because let's face it, every single time there's a screen, there's probably a chance of either a flop or a foul or both. I mean, wouldn't you agree that every time,
right,
if you're going to officiate a game with open posts being ran compared to, you know, 7, 8, 9 screens per possession being set, you probably prefer the less contact, don't you?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. That's for sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, fans, this was a great topic. Let us know what liar, liar, what you want to hear Jeremy talk about in this segment. Do want to remind you here in closing that, again, we're off 2 weeks. We want to thank you, Bruce Knox, and all you do, DBK Media Services. Really need to thank Triple Crown Family Fun Center. I know a lot of people already know this, but the podcast part of the website, we don't really do it to make any money. The Triple Crown Family Fun Center pretty much financially is the number one support of the entire show. Jeremy, I know I appreciate you volunteering your time. Jeremy makes nothing for this. So to Bruce and to all the people there at Triple Crown Family Fun Center, and to you, Jeremy, I wish you guys Merry Christmas, Happy New Year to you and your families. So I look forward to getting back after it in January and seeing how the holiday break here plays out and seeing where this SVC race and the boys and girls get as we hit the halfway point. So on that note, until next time, we here at SVCSportsZone.com say Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all of you in the Cider Valley Conference and throughout our entire listening area. And remember, even during the holiday season, while we are away, it is a must that you keep visiting SVCSportsZone.com, where we are 100% SVC, 100% of the time.
You've been listening to the Triple Crown Family Fun Center, SVC Sports Talk. SVC Sports Talk is brought to you by SVCSportsZone.com and Triple Crown Family Fun Center. Join us next time for the Triple Crown Family Fun Center, SVC Sports Talk. And visit SVCSportsZone.com, where we're 100% SVC, 100% of the time. Frost nipping at your nose. You type carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos.